Hello and welcome to the Mr. Brown podcast, where I reflect on my journey as an early career teacher, with a special focus on mental health. I am your host, James Brown. Good morning. The first thing that I'd like to talk about today is motivation. Again, I do spend a lot of time talking about motivation. I'm doing a MA in character education at the moment, and what I'm studying at the moment is quite motivation heavy. I'm looking at how we can motivate students to be good. Not just good students, but good people. It's a big question. But I'm interested in academic motivation as well. And I think much of this interest is driven by this idea that I have that a good teacher is in fact just a good motivator. If you can motivate students to learn, they will learn. They'll go away and do it themselves. Whatever hurdles are placed in front of them, they'll find a way to get over them or around them, and they will learn if they're properly motivated. However, if a student is unmotivated, couldn't care less, it doesn't matter what resources they have access to, what people they have around them, they won't learn. They'll be thinking about something else. So, yeah, I do think a good teacher is a good motivator. And today I wanted to say something about the relationship between success and motivation. So my Year 7 class recently experienced a great deal of success, and I was very happy for them. They did a spiral assessment, which is basically just a big assessment on everything they've learned so far. And they did very well. The class average was just over 85%. And in our school, we have two parallel populations in Year 7, the A population and the B population. There are three sets in the A population and three sets in the B population. And typically the sets in the B population are just slightly below the sets in the A population in terms of attainment or ability, whatever you want to call it. So 7A1 is the top set. 7B1 would be the second set. 7A2 would be third. 7B2 would be fourth. That's my class, 7B2. Then it would be 7A3 and 7B3. So in effect, I teach set four. Now, their spiral result was so good that they managed to leapfrog, in terms of the average score, not only 7A2, but also 7B1. So the average score for my class was better than the two sets above them. And my initial reaction was one of sheer delight. I was just so proud of my students. They really had worked so hard. But then these questions started to creep in. What if I had done something a little wrong? Now, I think there are lots of reasons why they did really well. And I think there are some reasons also why other classes didn't do so well. For example, I think the classes in the A population missed a lesson due to strike action in the build-up to the spiral assessment. So that would certainly have an effect. But going back to my class, what if I taught too much to the test? I admittedly did teach to the test. I had a look at the spiral assessment. I pulled out what I thought were the four trickiest questions. Just as a little bit of context, if you've never listened to an episode of this podcast before, I'm a maths teacher. Okay. So on the spiral assessment, this maths assessment, I picked out what I thought were the four trickiest and most valuable questions in terms of marks. And we did those sorts of questions every single lesson as a starter, and they also did them for homeworks. All the rest of the topics we covered one by one during the 4 or 5 lessons that we had in preparation for the spiral assessment. And again, as we covered those topics, they were very similar to the questions that were going to appear on the spiral assessment. So admittedly, I did teach very much to the test. And this might be a bad thing. If I teach too much to the test, then perhaps I've deprived my students of a more general understanding on these topics. Then again, we worked on the general understanding when we first encountered those topics in the lessons, weeks or months before. When we were building up to the spiral assessment, I did want to zoom in on the sorts of questions that they were going to encounter. And to bring this back to motivation, according to Rosenshine's Principles of Instruction, which are very influential in education, the optimal success rate is around 80%. My class got 85, that's around 80%. Now, why is that optimal? Because it shows that students are learning, but that they're also being challenged. So they've achieved enough success to feel good at what they're doing. They feel competent, which is essential for motivation. Yet they also have room to grow into. There's still 20%, 15% that they missed, and which they could aim to get next time. Now, I don't think I've ever had an issue with motivation with this class in general. I think, in general, they are quite well motivated. But there does seem to have been an increase since the spiral assessment. Students seem to be asking more questions, especially questions about the next unit assessment. Will this question be on the unit assessment? If I write this is my answer, would that get me the marks on the unit assessment? Those sorts of questions, which perhaps reveals an increase in motivation. I just hope for them that it hasn't become solely about getting marks. I wouldn't like to undermine their intrinsic motivation for the subject. So this has been a bit of a ramble. Let me try and bring it all back together. So I guess my question is this. If 80% is the optimal success rate, according to Rosenshine's principles, then to what lengths should we as teachers go to ensure our students get 80%? If it's a very weak set in terms of ability, should we all but give them the answers so that they just need to copy them down and therefore achieve around 80%? Would that be good for their motivation? I wouldn't have thought so. I certainly didn't give my students the answers, but I did teach to the test, and they did get around about 80%, and they do seem to be more motivated. But did I deprive them of something? Perhaps I deprived them of the opportunity to struggle in the assessment. Maybe they found it too easy. It must be a good thing to experience difficulties in an assessment, because they'll no doubt experience difficulties in the real thing when they take their GCSE. So there seems to be lots of different competing considerations here, and it's tricky to find a balance. I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on this one. Okay, so from my Year 7 Maths class to my Year 7 Computer Science class, I wanted to tell you about a particularly nice lesson I had recently. I was teaching Python, the programming language, and we were doing inputs. Now, I don't plan these lessons. They're planned by the head of department, and they're brilliant lessons. I just have to deliver them. And this one in particular was fantastic. It started with me asking them whether they knew what Mad Libs were. Now, the first time the head of department asked me whether I knew what Mad Libs were, I think I said no, so there wasn't much hope for my Year 7s, and indeed none of them knew at all. So it's an old word game. It used to feature in certain magazines. I'm just going to read the Wikipedia description. The Mad Libs game consists of one player prompting others for a list of words to substitute for blanks in a story before reading it aloud. So The other players don't know the story. They're just being asked for words. They provide these words. Then they're inserted into this story and the story is read aloud. And the story is often very entertaining. Now, the reason we were talking about Mad Libs is because you can think of these words as inputs. So the idea was that students would write a program that would ask the user for words, and then the program would print a story using those words. But before we got onto the programming, we played the Mad Libs game on paper so they got an idea of what it was all about. They each had a blank piece of paper. At the very top, I asked them to write the name of a male celebrity. They would then fold that over so it couldn't be seen and pass the piece of paper to the left. The next person, underneath the fold, would write the name of a female celebrity. Fold it over, pass it to the left. The next person writes down the name of something you could sit on. Okay, fold, pass to the left. Then something that he said to her. The he being the male celebrity and the her being the female celebrity. But of course, they don't know who they were because of the folds. They just need to write down something that he said to her. That's all they get. Write that down, fold, pass to the left. Then something that she said to him, so a response, fold, pass to the left. And then finally, something you could eat, fold, pass to the left. I was playing along too, so I had my piece of paper that was folded up. I then unraveled it and I read the story using the words that had been collected as inputs. And the structure of the story is like this. One day, male celebrity met female celebrity while sitting on a something, whatever the word that was given. He said to her something. She said to him, the response. Then they both went out to eat something. And some of these stories were fantastic. And the kids found it so entertaining. It was nice being in a classroom. It was just full of laughter. And I kept my favourite. I'll read it to you now. One day, Tony Stark met Zendaya while sitting on the floor. He said to her, "Make me a sandwich." She said to him, "Daddy, I don't want to play with you." Then they both went out to eat a banana. That one in particular was met with a great deal of laughter from me and the students, especially the... When reading that one, I realised I had made a bit of an error by not scanning the words before I started reading the stories. So I think I took a random selection of 4 or 5 and then read them all out at the start. And I just read them out. I didn't look at them beforehand. There could have been any words on there. So I think I got off quite lightly, in fact, with, "Daddy, I don't want to play with you." Could have been much worse. So that was a very fun lesson. And that activity gave the students a really good idea of what they were trying to achieve with the programming that came next. And indeed, I think they really accessed the task and learnt a lot. So thank you to the head of the computing department for planning such a wonderful lesson. The third thing I want to talk about is my productivity. I think it's important when you're a new teacher to keep an eye out for how you're improving. Because being a teacher is such a busy job that it would be easy not to notice that you're getting better at it. And one thing I noticed recently is that at the beginning of the year, I would decide what I was going to teach the following week on a Friday evening. So on a Friday evening after school, I'd sit down, look at the scheme of learning, and come up with my plan for the following week, what topics I was going to teach in which lessons. I wouldn't plan any of those lessons, but I'd just come up with the topics for those lessons. And that in itself could be quite an arduous undertaking at times. But I'd do that on a Friday evening, and then I would plan most of those lessons on a Sunday morning. And I still And I still do most of my planning on a Sunday morning in one big lump. But I noticed recently, in the past few weeks, that the time at which I plan my lesson topics for the following week is getting earlier and earlier. I used to do it on a Friday after school. Then I found myself with time during my free on a Friday. I would do it then. And it's crept earlier and earlier. And now I plan for the following week on a Thursday during my free. And then during my remaining free time for the rest of that week, I actually start planning the lessons, which massively reduces my workload on a Sunday. For my year nines, they read Fermat's Last Theorem, a book by Simon Singh, for their homework each week, and then we do a quiz on it during the lesson. I've started planning the quiz on a Wednesday during my free. I used to do that on a Sunday along with everything else. And so this can only mean that I'm being more efficient with my time. Things that once took me quite a while to do now aren't taking me as long. I have more time. And so those jobs can get done earlier. And my workload at the weekend is decreasing. And so I guess the moral of the story is, if you're a new teacher, be sure to keep an eye out for how you're improving. This one kind of surprised me. But it was certainly a pleasant surprise. And it gives me hope that one day I might be able to reclaim my weekends altogether. Now on to my mental health. I'd say my mental health on the whole has been good. I'd say my sense of purpose has never been stronger, nor has my sense of belonging. I love working with the people that I work with. And so depression couldn't be further away. Anxiety, however, has recently made a bit of a comeback. And I think this is just due to workload. And when I say workload, it isn't my teacher workload that's causing the problems. I find my teacher workload quite manageable. But I'm also doing a master's at the same time. And I tend to do some master's study in the evenings. But one of the great things about being a teacher is that every hour or so, a bell rings and you need to stop what you're doing and move on to the next thing. However, in the evenings when I'm doing my master's work, there are no bells and I can easily find myself spending several hours in the evening reading and writing. And that, along with everything else, can tip me into the red in terms of stress and anxiety. So just in the past few days, I have felt quite anxious. And I think it's the result of spending too much time in the evenings doing my master's work. But that's okay, because the fact that I have an idea about what it is means that I can address it. And also, it's half term next week. So half term has come at a good time. I'm going to do my best to rest and relax. And I need to start exercising again. I can tell that the sort of anxiety that I'm currently feeling, which is kind of a heaviness in the head, a pressure behind the nose, it would evaporate if I went on a run. It's the sort of thing that exercise would just burn off. So I must do some exercise. I hope this half term has gone well for you. It's been a good one for me. It was a 7-weeker, and I've heard that it's the worst half term because it's as long as the one before Christmas, except you don't have Christmas to look forward to. But it went okay. I got through it. I enjoyed it. And hopefully it's smooth sailing from here on out. We'll see. I'll keep you informed. This episode took around 2 hours to produce, which is about average, and I aim to produce 2 to 3 episodes a month. If you think that work is worth at least the price of a coffee, so that's £2 or £3 a month, then please consider becoming a patron and helping me cover the cost of producing the podcast, which currently stands at around about £13 a month, I think. That's just hosting fees. Any contribution would be greatly appreciated. As always, there's a link to my Patreon in the show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, please spread the word in person and on social media. You can follow me on Twitter at Mr. Brown Pod or email mrbrownpod@gmail.com. Please subscribe, rate and review in your directory of choice. Please also consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/mrbrownpod and helping me cover the cost of producing the podcast. Thank you and talk again soon.